Thank you for tuning in to the Best of Movie Geeks United, a collection of some of our most memorable conversations from our archives. Tonight, we welcome three terrific actors, beginning with Malcolm McDowell from A Clockwork Orange. Mr. McDowell took part in episode 3 of our Stanley Kubrick series, but the excerpt of conversation we feature here is about the other films that populate his resume outside of his famous collaboration with Mr. Kubrick. He's followed by Ed Harris, and then we conclude with a wonderful character actor, Paul Giamatti. And this is the first of a two parts of our interview with Malcolm McDowell that we're airing tonight. The second part will be part of the fabric of the third episode of our Kubrick series, which covers The Clockwork Orange, and that premieres Sunday, April 10th. But tonight, Malcolm's going to discuss with us his latest film, Pound of Flesh, which airs on Showtime this fall.
Oh,
and
okay.
You can read more about the film at poundoffleshmovie.com or follow American World Pictures on Facebook, and they'll give you the latest updates there as well. Also in this conversation, he discusses some of the other highlights of his career, including working with Bob Altman on the film The Company. So here is Malcolm.
My students aren't paying that much attention to me.
If you don't mind me asking you, what's your secret?
I pay them.
Barden College operates like any other school.
Welcome to Fourth Term Shakespeare.
But when the students run out of cash...
I can't afford the tuition, even with my grant.
Then they have a special scholarship.
I was thinking about giving you an A.
That's all?
It's more like going out on dates.
Would you like to sit down?
I'm into my nap.
Do you have any idea what I just did?
Scholarship? They don't care what they're called as long as the girls are young and hot.
If college girls gone wild...
Why do I care if I have sex with one person or 50 people?
Until someone turns up dead.
You know, with shoes like that, church on Sunday.
The cops have their own problems.
I'm a very good detective, Sergeant.
But it's not going to take a genius to bring this school down.
To Rachel, her brains, her beauty.
We have never escaped.
Do you know what turning college girls into hookers gets you?
Game's over, Noah.
Malcolm McDowell. Angus McFadden. Timothy Bottoms, star in Pound of Flesh from American World Pictures.
Well, let's talk about A Pound of Flesh first.
Okay.
This was a really fascinating movie to me, and in researching it, I was also interested to find out. I mean, this is based on a true story as well.
Yes, it's based on a true story. I mean, just the basic facts of, you know, college professor in a Eastern university somewhere, I think it's Virginia somewhere, you know, set up an escort agency for the girls to pay for their education, basically.
Mm.
And I think the thing that struck us all, you know, Tammy and myself anyway, was the sort of hypocrisy of... hounding this guy for this outrage of, you know, supposedly influencing minors, you know, and making them depraved, ha-ha, as if they're not having sex anyway. You know, and so that's what interested us. And, you know, I always like the character, and the fact is, you know, I tried to make him affable and, you know, intelligent and all that, and, you know, a really good teacher, and so that there is a little conflict there, you know.
Absolutely. And it does talk about the hypocrisy of sex, the way we view sex, in a very dynamic way. But I know that you've worked with Tammy before. She said that she wrote this character for you. In general, when someone says that they write a character for you, does that kind of
you
make
run
you...
the other way? No, you run the other way.
Right.
You're sort of then you're sort of duty bound to do it. You know.
Mm-hmm. Well,
she's a terrific writer, and I know her well enough to say, look, if I wanted to pass, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I was intrigued by this. I think it's a very interesting dilemma that he's in, and it was a very interesting character to me. And also, I got to work with my daughter, which was another nice thing about it. So, mm-hmm. It's a very modest film. It was made for very little money. We all did it just to do it, you know. If you really want to do them, for absolutely nothing. I mean, $200,000 or $300,000, I don't even know what it costs. Nothing.
Right.
Very little amount of money. But everybody worked very hard, and they believed in it, and they did it for the right reason. So we got a really nice film out of it, you know.
And you've worked on all kinds of movies. I mean, you've been in the business for so long, the big budget studios and the independent films. Is there a different feeling for you, a different challenge for you as an actor, depending upon the scale of the film?
Not as an actor, really, because when you come down to it, that's basically all the same. You know, but of course, it's from being on a big budget film. Actually, sometimes it's not as much fun because, you know, they want to just repeat it over and mm-hmm. over at mm-hmm. every single angle known to man because God knows the director, you know, doesn't want to screw up and have the studio on his back, and he better have every shot in the book so that they can, you know, invent it in the editing room, you know.
Right. Right.
That's a real bore because you know basically when going in you don't need all these shots. It's just a complete extravagant and waste.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean that's basically. So what I'm saying is that if you have real boundaries. You can make better movies sometimes. I'm not saying always, but sometimes. It depends on the subject. But if you're given very little money, sometimes you have to invent stuff that you wouldn't have even thought of, you know, that you mm-hmm. have to sort of be thinking on your feet and moving fast. And that can be fun. I love that. You know, I love that. And that's why I enjoy working in television because, you know, you get one shot, you do it, boom, you're on.
Mm-hmm.
You're moving
mm-hmm.
on, you know. So, I like that. I like that, and I like to find it, you know, fast. And if I can't find it fast, then, hey, I like to have the luxury of a bit of time to find it.
Right. Right. Well, that's what I've heard from the others that I've interviewed, that the pace of an independent production usually gives it the special kind of energy. You don't necessarily have an opportunity to second-guess yourself. There's a lot of instinct
right.
involved. And you're forced to find creative solutions rather than throwing money at something.
Yeah, and you know, that very rarely works, does it, throwing money at something?
Right, I mean, it just
doesn't. Because, and there's so many good examples of that, you know, but the thing is to, you know, find a happy medium, I guess. That's the ideal, but... You know, and also, you know, it's also nice to be paid for doing something because, you know, we all have to pay mortgages and all the rest of it and school fees. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm not saying, hey, work for free and do these little independent movies, you know, but I do think that for me anyway, I can only speak personally, I like to do a mix of stuff. And I've done a couple, I think this year, sort of, you know, freebies, a cheap one, you know, for very little money, and that's fine, just to help somebody or I found it, you know, an interesting subject or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, I've done that this year, and I've kind of enjoyed that, and now I'm waiting for a bigger one.
Well, when you've played so many diverse characters, when you get a character like Melville, what did you latch on to? What was the special, unique challenge that you found in crafting that character?
Well, you know, I think that I wanted to make him a moral, on the surface anyway, a moral human being, a nice man, an interesting man, an intelligent man, one who's obviously knows what he's talking about. He's, you know, a professor of English literature, Shakespearean, he loves his Shakespeare, all that, and but not a bore with it. You know, I didn't want to make him a bore with it and quoting all the time, but an interesting teacher, someone that you could inspire a class of students. And I wanted to do that, and I wanted also to make him, to make the relationship with his wife a loving one.
Mm-hmm.
So that I didn't want it to feel like he was getting off on putting the girls out to an escort.
Right.
So it's not personal. It wasn't personal. He would never cheat on his wife. He was in love with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to make sure that that was very clear. And that it was to help, really, at the end of the day, it was to help these girls. Of course, it was very naive of him. You know, very, very naive. You know, I mean, this sort of thinking that anyone else would understand, you know, this stuff. But, you know, he's a bit of an idealist, really, Noah Melville,
right,
in a way, and in a world that won't countenance such naivety, because, you know, you're dealing with, you know, the daughters and sons of prominent people or whatever, you know, and so... I don't know, you know, that corrupting minors and all stuff like that comes into it.
Right.
And I think it's a great hypocrisy, actually, that we as a nation have. But, of course, we do have that. And let's face it, America is, in terms of sex, you know, and the body, incredibly hypocritical. And you can't even see an ass crack on television. You can see somebody's brains being blown out. But you see an ass crack, they put it out, or a breast or something. It's so ludicrous. It's like,
right,
who are we kidding here? I mean, this is like sort of juvenile stuff. It's just so, you know, so crazy to me. But then, you know, I have a European sensibility, I suppose, even though I'm totally American.
Well, what Americans deem offensive usually mystifies me. I mean, and primetime television, you're absolutely right. The kind of graphic things that you see, but the natural human state is offensive in some way. You know.
Yes, even in death, even if you see things at the awful shots of these poor victims of the tsunami, their clothes have been ripped off, they're blurted out, even in death. It's like, it's just absolutely crazy, you know. But having said that, you know, I don't know. Would I let my children see it? Absolutely, I would. You know, we're not sheepish in our house about, you know, parading around, you know, with nothing on. I mean, you know, that's just the state that we are in.
You know, you're talking about all of these ideas of the character or the themes of the film. When you're actually doing it, when you're shooting the film, at this stage in your career, do you instinctively know that it's working, or is there always an uncertainty?
Oh, well, you know whether the character's working. You don't know whether the film is.
Mm.
Because you can't know that, because, you know, until it's actually cut together, you never know. I always felt this character worked, you know, really rather well. And you know, of course, we had to do work in post to the voiceover and some of the Shakespeare quotes, which are some of my favorites, that I could bring in, you know, because I was, years and years ago when I first started acting, a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, and I hated it. I loathed it. It was like working for the government. I used to say, it's almost, you know, when you're working for an institution where it's impossible to get fired, you know you're in real trouble. you know, however bad you were or naughty or whatever, you, it was impossible to get fired. So because they just didn't do it, they just wouldn't fire you. But I do remember some beautiful pieces. It's funny that Shakespeare's come back into my
yes.
life, you know, because I did this Shakespeare readings at the Disney Hall with Boutamel doing the Tchaikovsky, you know, Hamlet, The Tempest, and Romeo and Juliet the other day, last weekend. It was incredible. It was so beautiful.
It is beautiful language.
What an amazing, yes, beautiful language, but, you know, the Tchaikovsky music was so exciting, and this, you know, Guttermel is one of the geniuses of our age.
Mm.
It was amazing. It was amazing. So it's a sort of circle for me. It's sort of come back into my life very happily, because all the thoughts I had as a kid at the Royal Shakespeare Company, and it was only basically because, you know, you were required to move a lot of furniture. You know, being a young member of the company, you know, pick up this table and move it over there and do this. I mean, that was basically, you know, wait for your chance, you know. It was one of those. And when your chance came, it was some, you know, Ponzi prince or something, you know, very uninteresting. But you know, it was a world-famous company.
Right.
I mean, I always figured, well, I tried really hard to get into the damn place, and then I couldn't wait to get out. You know, it was one of those. But
before I let you go, I just want to tell you that, you know, I'm also crazy about Robert Altman. And my two favorite films of Altman's, I love McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and I love The Company. Those are my two favorites. So, and I love you.
Oh, my God. Oh, thank you. I love Bob Altman. He was an American original,
mm-hmm.
a genius. I mean, if they ever want to know what happened in America in this period, 60s on, 70s, 80s, 90s, to the 2010, then they just got to look at Robert Altman's films.
Yeah.
Because he loved this country, and, you know, he made some extraordinary movies. And just to work with the man, now I was friends with him we're going back to 1970. We hung in London and you know, we're naughty boys together. And we always laughed. And we'd always get together. I mean, if we found ourselves in the same city, he'd show up. He showed up, you know, when I was doing Caligula in Rome and stuff like this, just hilarious stuff. Going, hey, kid, I got to come down and see this set. A lot of naked women out here. Yeah, and guys, too. He goes, oh, okay. So, you know, we'd have a good laugh. I just love the guy. And anyway, I was doing, at the Lincoln Center, they showed this movie I did called Gangster Number One.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Altman was in the audience for the Q&A, and I went, oh, my God. I went, everybody, one of the greatest directors ever is sitting right here, and I have to say, will you just wave? It's Robert Altman. And people applauded him, and he waved. Anyway, we went to dinner afterwards, and he looks at me, and he goes, can you dance? I went, can I dance? God, how old do you think I am? I went, no, hell no, I can't dance. He goes, I'm doing a little dance movie. He goes, anyway, I don't need you to dance. I went, okay, whatever. And that was The Company. And little Nev, who I saw last week, she came to the Disney thing.
Mm-hmm.
She did so well with that and got Bob. How, you know, she did a great job with him. And you know, because she was a dancer and all that.
It's not the steps, baby. It's what's inside that really counts. That's when you really begin to soar.
From director Robert Altman and the acclaimed Joffrey Ballet, an intimate look at the life of a company. The life of a dancer.
I've always believed in you.
Nev Campbell. James Franco. And Malcolm McDowell.
Hit the wall! I want you to move out!
The discipline.
Thinking the movement is not becoming the movement.
The sacrifice. The beauty. The passion of dance.
Into this ballet.
The Company, a Robert Altman film.
When I look at The Company, I think he finally did it, because I'd read interviews with him where he said, I want to explode this three-act structure that movies depend upon. I want to transcend that. And I said, he did it with The Company. I saw it. It was an enormous accomplishment, I thought.
Yeah, I do too. And also, you know, he just loved these dancers. He loved what they did. He didn't understand it. He just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, I just want to lift the curtain up a little bit and have a little look backstage about what's going on.
Mm.
And he goes, you follow this guy around. This was the guy, the head of a wonderful guy called Gerald Arpino, who ran the Joffrey Ballet in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And he was just like that character in a way, but we couldn't, you know, because he wore such a ridiculous hairpiece, we couldn't call him Arpino, so he called me something else. We were laughing about it. I said, do you want me to do it with this ridiculous hairpiece? He goes, oh God, no, we'll just call you something else. But we had such a ball. Oh my God. Altman was a treasure. He was one of the greats. I got to work, you know, with some of the real fabulous directors. And another one I loved, a great, great comedy director, was Blake Edwards.
Oh, yeah.
And what a great director he was. I mean, he's very, you know, underrated, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He was an absolutely one of the great comedy directors ever, I think.
And you've played a lot of heavies, but with the there seems to be a great interest that you have in finding the comedy in these characters.
Well, I always look for the comedy first, because that's always the most interesting way to go to me. And also, if you're playing a heavy, you make him funny, it's way more deadly. You know, you don't have to do anything.
Mm.
I mean, you can go around strutting around, you know. Well, I mean, look, I'll tell you a good example. What's his name? My cousin Vinny.
Pesci.
Pesci. He's hilarious. I mean, look at him in Goodfellas. Absolutely hilarious. And so deadly. And I mean, you know, he makes me roar with laughter. He's brilliant, you know.
Very much.
It makes it way more sort of deadly if I've always felt that bringing out the comedic side is always the best way to go.
4-time Academy Award nominee Ed Harris. Can you guys name me the 4 nominations?
Pollock.
Yes.
Okay, History of Violence.
Apollo. Nope. Apollo 13.
Yes.
And is it the right stuff?
No.
No, you didn't get it? Okay. Who got? Did anyone get nominated acting wise for that?
No.
Shepard?
Oh, Sam Shepard did.
That's okay. Good. Well, I'm glad someone did.
Let's see. Apollo 13. Oh my God!
History of Violence? Didn't he get it for History of Violence?
No, it was William Hurt that got the nomination for History of
Violence. Oh, William Hurt. Okay, all right.
Oh, I can't remember the other two. Not the Sweet Dreams or Alamo Bay or?
No.
All good performances, by the way.
Oh, it's a terrific performance. He got nominated for The Truman Show.
The Truman Show, right.
He was a last-minute replacement of Dennis Hopper in that movie.
Right. That would have been a different movie.
And then he was nominated for The Hours.
Oh, really? I forgot about that. I forgot he was in that. That guy just blows me away every time.
You talk about great performances, Jackknife with Robert De Niro.
I was thinking about that today. That's a good movie. Really good movie.
Sweet Dreams with Jessica Lange. State of Grace with Gary Oldman. The Abyss. I remember reading stories or interviews with him about The Abyss, and he said he did not like making that movie. He did not like it. He's great in that movie.
He is really great in that movie.
But he said that was such a pressure cooker situation shooting that movie that one day he was driving home from the set and he had to pull off on the side of the road and he just broke down and cried. He said the intensity of that shoot was just overwhelming.
It actually makes its way into the performance itself because, you know, the number one thing that I remember about that performance is him telling Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio to fight.
Where he's trying to resuscitate her, yeah.
Yeah,
that's a great thing. Glengarry Glen Ross. I mean,
everyone's great in that.
Oh, my God. And then, of course, Pollock, which was his absolute passion. I always loved the movie, the Prime Gig, which is the salesman movie he did with the Vince Vaughn. That's a great movie. On and on and on. Great movies. His latest movie is called Phantom. It's an intense film that takes place on a Soviet submarine that could hold the fate of the world within its grasp. So it's a very intense, claustrophobic, character-driven movie. It's in theaters now, and it co-stars David Duchovny. And here is Ed to tell us all about that film and a whole lot more about the craft of acting.
Stop the drill, Captain.
Why?
Because our orders require us to take tactical advantage of the testing opportunities that classified onboard equipment.
Captain, I need you to put us under that ship.
We have men below.
Then you should get them out.
Scott, we have a problem in battery deck 2.
Yeah, what is it?
Not sure, sir. The men are coming up now.
Mr. Kozlov, terminate the drill.
Aye, sir. All hands, terminate drill. Captain,
what?
Put us under that ship.
Sir, we don't know who that is. Mr. Babin, I'll plot an intercept for that ship. Put the moon on our stern.
Aye, Captain.
Sir. Level the boat. Make our depth 10 meters.
Level the boat. Depth 10 meters.
Aye, aye. Level the boat. 10 meters.
We'll take a look before we get any closer. If that's all right with you.
Hey, Jimmy.
Hi, Mr. Harris. How are you, sir?
I'm good.
I appreciate the time very much. I'm a big admirer of your work, so thank you so much.
Welcome. How's Movie Geeks going?
Movie Geeks is going very well. And speaking of geeking out on movies, I really liked yours. I thought it was incredibly intense and effective.
Good.
And I guess to start out with, I'm curious, when you read the script, what were the challenges associated with your character that that most appealed to you?
Well, let's see. The challenges that were the most apparent to me were, what the hell is he talking about half the time?
yeah.
And what appealed to me was his, you know, this guy who has this kind of, you see, this burden that he's carrying with him, not only his dad having been this big shot in the, you know, in terms of writing the book on Russian submarine warfare, but this incident that had happened earlier in his career that has affected him both physically and psychologically over the years, and professionally, you know, and how he was dealing with that. I also appreciated his friendship with the character that William Fichtner played. The main challenge to me was I didn't really know anything about submarines, how they operated or anything. So, you know, doing my research along those lines and getting familiar with what I was talking about half the time.
Well, you've done such a beautiful honor to your profession with your work over the years. And so it's obvious that you know how to recognize a well-rounded character on the page. But for the layperson, how do you go about that? Is it looking at it and any question you have about your character is answered in the text? Is that how you recognize it?
Possibly, or if the unanswered questions are interesting ones that you are excited about filling in for yourself. It's really an instinctive kind of thing, I think, more or less. Plus a script can be a really good story and not be well written. And then you're going, yeah, this is a good story, but these words, nobody talks like this, or God, it's set up, it's structured poorly, or you know what I mean? So
yeah,
there's a lot of things going on when you're reading the script in terms of the feel of it and just how you can see it being translated onto the screen cinematically and who the director is and all kinds of stuff, you know.
Absolutely. You know, because I always hear the phrase, it's the most important thing to ask the question and maybe not even know the answer, but as long as you ask the question. And I haven't always been 100% certain what exactly that means.
Well, I'm not either. I think some questions need to be answered in terms of playing a character, for sure. But you have to know what questions to ask yourself to begin with, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, my daughter's 19 years old, so let's say she's having a problem about something. Instead of giving her answers, you know, maybe I'll ask her questions about what's going on with her. And she can think about them, answer them for herself if she cares to. So a director is more doing that, I think, with character than he is answering things.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, here's a character, why is he this way? Or what, fill in the blanks here, you know, what was his relationship with his father? What does he really feel about what happened when he had this accident and he had to sacrifice the lives of, you know, a number of his crewmen? I mean, how does that affect him? Obviously, on the page, you know he's been affected by it and thinks about it, but internally, how are you going to, you know, how are you going to deal with that?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of hard to talk about, but
In terms of playing scenes and playing these moments, I mean, this is a very intense claustrophobic piece, and there are a lot of great scenes with your fellow actors. And movies, by their nature, are very kind of stop and start. I mean, you work on moments. Were you able to achieve kind of a rhythm where you were able to let a scene breathe and not so much stop and start?
First of all, we were shooting, you know, we shot the whole film in 21 days, so we were filming a lot every day. There was not a lot of waiting around, you know, so that was really good because you were always involved during the day with your character and what was happening. So, you know, I mean, any given scene, we would work it in terms of the flow of it, in terms of the rhythm of working. It kind of seemed to take care of itself because we were always, you know, involved. And you become so familiar with the story and what happens when and when. Okay, when this is with this tanker, this is with this Russian sub, this is when he does the Phantom thing, blah 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 blah. You know, so whether you're shooting in sequence or not, you're aware of where you are in the story. You know, what's being called upon for your character to do.
When you look at the movie now, and I would imagine you've seen the movie, correct?
Well, I just really saw it once, and not in a big theater. I mean, I saw it. It was a screening room. It was a fairly good sized screen, but I was kind of close to it. It was close physically to the screen. Mm. Didn't really have a perspective on it. So, kind of looking forward to where they're screening it tomorrow night at the, you know, big Vance Chinese Theater here in Hollywood. So I'm kind of looking forward to seeing it on a big screen with some distance.
Yeah.
But I think it works. I mean, I'm really proud of Todd, you know. This idea he'd been working on for a couple of years, and he pulled it off.
And it was shot on a real submarine?
Yeah, it was shot on a Russian sub that's in San Diego, part of a naval museum down there. It's in the water, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's not, it can't be submerged, but it's, you know, it's in the water, and we shot 98% of the movie in that sub.
Wow.
And it's not very big.
But it must have been, I mean, that must have done a lot of work for you.
Well, definitely. It was great shooting in there. I mean, can you imagine shooting in a real sub as opposed to, okay, now we're on a soundstage in Burbank, you know,
right.
And here's your set for the sub. It's like, yeah, no. Sorry.
Well, I wanted to ask you, too, about your directing, because I've loved the films that you've directed.
Yeah, well, I hope there's another one in there.
I do, too.
Soon.
I'm curious about that, because when you, I mean, you have to be so passionate to direct a film about and invested in the material you're working
right,
on.
Right, exactly.
So when you go from that, being kind of in charge of the whole pie, to just being an actor and being in charge of your slice, really, is that a tough adjustment?
It's a huge letdown. Well, it's not really like a letdown. It's just really different. I love the two experiences I've had directing have really been, I've really enjoyed them, as hard as they may have been, particularly the Pollock thing. But I really want to direct more. It's just like you said, I have to be, it has to touch something so deep in me. I have to, you know, and I haven't found that thing that I want to commit myself to spend that kind of time with. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself a filmmaker as much as I do someone who, when he finds something, wants to make a film out of, he does it.
Jackson Pollock, I'm Lee Krasner. I thought I knew all the abstract artists in New York, and I don't know Jackson Pollock.
What do you think of the cops?
Yeah, how's it been?
Dick Cooning.
He's all right. He's learning.
What's she doing here?
You need to get cleaned up.
I have just climbed up and down 5 flights of stairs. I'm Peggy Guggenheim.
They're sorry.
My God, and you're drunk.
No.
No.
What you're doing is the most original
and vigorous art in the country.
We're broke.
You just keep at it.
I'm keeping at it. Don't tell me to keep at it.
We spoke, I believe it was upon Appaloosa's release. We did a long conversation with Jeff Beal, because we're crazy about film composition on the show,
right.
too. And
right.
he, one of our favorite conversations, and actually that was my favorite score that year. So we've been big cheerleaders for your directorial work for a while.
All right, well, hopefully I can get one going here in the next year or two.
Yeah.
Speaking of music, you know, Rona did really interesting. There's a thing on YouTube, Jeff Rona. If you look up Jeff Rona, whatever, dash Phantom, there's a little piece that somebody did of him talking about how he did the music for this film. Because he went in that sub and, like, recorded all these sounds, clinking sounds. You know, he's knocking on all these different kinds of things and getting all these different sounds that he kind of, you know, put into the mix and computerized and changed around. It was kind of cool.
I saw that. That was a beautiful experiment. Last question that I'll ask you, because I know you're pressed for time, but I'm curious, since you've been doing this for so long, if acting means something different to you now than it did when you first started.
Well, I don't know if it means something different to me. You know, I don't know. I like to think, you know, something that you just keep working at and growing with. So probably maybe a little more relaxed with it than I used to be in some level. But I don't really know. I mean, I still enjoy it. You know, I actually really enjoy doing theater. I hope to be doing this play in New York in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And so I still do enjoy it.
Do you feel that your process is simplified now from where it was when it started?
I just think there's less tension about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like I understand what I need to do better. I don't do more than I need to do. I do what I need to do what I have to do. I don't waste energy doing it, which doesn't mean I won't spend energy, but I just have, I think, a certain amount of confidence and trust myself in terms of preparation, that kind of thing. And And the act of doing it, you know, on the camera, in front of the camera is, you know, it's just, you just keep trying to keep probing the truth and, you know, finding ways to keep things interesting.
Mm-hmm. And what's the play you're doing next? You said you're
well, it's a play, a new Beth Henley play called The Jacksonian that we did here, Amy, my wife, and I, and Bill Pullman.
Right.
And
yeah.
Glenn Headley, we did it at the Geffen. I think we're going to do it in New York in the fall at the Acorn Theater.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah,
that would be great.
Looking forward to it. Excited about that.
Well, I appreciate your time very much, and thank you for all the great work. It means a lot to me.
Well, you're welcome, Jamie. I hope I can keep doing it for you for a number of years.
I'm as political officer in this boat as your friend. It's my duty to tell you that if you even imply treasonous intent to elite KGB officers without proper evidence or cause, you'll be put up for charges of misconduct of the code of military justice.
Sometimes a man has to pick a side, Greg.
Well, then you should pick wisely. Because if you're wrong, this will haunt you and your families for the rest of your lives. And it won't matter who your father is.
Yay.
Actor Paul Giamatti, writer-director Don Coscarelli, they have a new movie out. It's called John Dies at the End. It's the, I mean, how do I describe John Dies at the End? It's a trippy
the
movie. Well, it's completely trippy, and it's obvious from the first frames that it's not anything you've seen before. It's like a story of some underground street drug and how it causes hallucinations, and you don't know what's reality and what's not, and it's all these time dimensions. And I mean, it's a crazy, crazy movie that keeps you on your toes as a viewer. Paul Giamatti's actually kind of like the voice of reason in it, so he feels like a big balance in this pool of madness that is the movie. And it's totally visionary, and it's amazing how they shot this on an independent budget because they accomplished some extraordinary things. But we spoke to both of them about John Dies at the End and some other great stuff from their career. And the first interview you'll hear is Paul Giamatti, and then it'll go to Don Coscarelli. John Dies at the End is available now on demand systems worldwide. I'm sure worldwide. That's available worldwide, right? On demand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would think so. And it's open in select theaters starting this weekend. Here's Paul and Don.
Someday you will face the unimaginable. It is physically impossible to avoid it.
You got my attention, Mr. Wong.
This slack stuff, this sauce.
You can see things you shouldn't be able to. If I show you what's in this container, you'll never feel at one with the human race.
I realized all at once, my one chance to save the universe lay inside this bottle.
It'd be opening doors to a world of mine.
What is that stuff, John?
The soy sauce?
That stuff.
I'm remembering things that haven't happened yet.
We were chosen by the soy sauce.
So you guys are what?
Some kind of spiritualist exorcist?
Something like that.
I feel like Don Coscarelli's movies, pretty much all of them are pretty original. I mean, he's got a very, very unique way of going about things and a unique tone and sort of vision, and he just follows it through. And I feel like all of his movies are not like anything else I've ever seen. So that was a huge part of the appeal and made me very eager to be a part of making this. Yeah.
Yeah, and you had actually first met with him for Bubba Nosferatu, was it?
Yes. Yes, I had.
And you know, you can admire a person's work, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the two of you will gel creatively. So what is it that makes that possible for you two?
I think we have a similar sense of humor to some extent. I don't know. I mean, there's just something very, you know, and I appreciated when I actually worked with him. I appreciated the way I knew he was going to be like this. And he's incredibly efficient and in control and,
gets the job done, and I really like that kind of thing, and he's that kind of guy, and, you know, so there was that, and then I just think that there's some similar sensibility in certain ways. It overlaps. I don't know. And it's just, I mean, it's not just that we were lucky that we got along together. It's just that to get the opportunity, you know, you see these things you admire, and you know, 90% of the time you don't ever meet the person who made it or whatever. And so it was just great to be able to get the opportunity to do it.
Yeah. I'm curious from an acting standpoint, if it's more difficult to play the reality of a scene when the reality of the movie is so outlandish?
No, I think part of the pleasure is that it's so outlandish and it can be real and you can go there. I mean, I enjoy outlandish things. I always have, you know, when I acted on stage, I always liked doing oddball out there things too. I like it when it's unreal, just as much as, you know, it's fantastic to play the real circumstances of something. It's the fun of it is doing something completely bizarre and absurd. That's really pleasurable to me. You don't get to do it a whole lot, and so I find that more exciting than not.
And you've really got to, I don't know how to put this delicately, but you have to not be afraid to feel like a fool, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, in general, to be an actor, you have to not be afraid to look like a fool because, you know, I mean, you're potentially going to look like a fool doing most anything. But you definitely, with this stuff, even more so. And you know, again, part of the pleasure, you're absolutely right. You're going to look like a fool. It's foolish and fun. That's part of the idea. So,
yeah.
No, yeah, you definitely can't have any qualms about that. But I feel like if you have any qualms about that, you shouldn't be an actor, you know, because you're going to look like a fool at some point, no matter what.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I can't imagine reading this script for the first time and thinking to yourself, how in the world is he going to realize all of this madness?
The really bizarre thing is that we had been talking about doing this Baba Nosferatu movie, which was in its own way complicated, but nowhere near as complicated as this was. And when the money for that fell through and he put it aside, he gave me this script and I read it and he said, yeah, this will be actually easier to do. And I remember just thinking, how the hell could this possibly be easy to do? I was like, how the hell are you going to do the dog driving the car? Any of this? How are you going to do the meat? I mean, all of it was just, it seemed so audacious, so unbelievably ambitious. But he was really confident that he knew exactly how this was not going to be easy to do. And it wasn't easy to do, but I was amazed at how much, yes, it proved to be that he knew exactly how he was going to get the meat monster made, and he knew exactly how he was going to do Korok and things like that. And
wow.
It was amazing.
Wow.
It's a hugely ambitious movie. It's a movie that should cost bazillions of dollars, actually, but it didn't.
I feel the same way when I saw it. And speaking of seeing it for the first time, what was your reaction? Did you see it for the first time at Sundance or earlier?
Yeah. I'd seen it along the way. When I would be out in L.A., sometimes I would always stop by and see him, and he would show me stuff cut together. And I don't think I ever saw the whole thing cut together where he was editing it. But so I was familiar enough with it, but I had not seen it screened like that, all done, everything done like that. And it was great. You know, I've almost never been so pleased about something I've been a part of to see that it came together like that. I mean, it's heroic that this thing got pulled off the way it did. You know, I mean, it really is it's just fantastic. I'm incredibly pleased it came off the way it did.
Yeah, and it's the kind of movie that, hardcore fans and geeks like me are going to definitely gravitate towards. And I feel the same way about American Splendor, which happened closer to the beginning of your career. Do you feel that kind of presence when you make a movie that taps into a fan base?
Yeah, sometimes you can feel that, and it's a really nice thing. Totally, and that's a good... American Splendor had that feeling to it, too, that you were really appealing to somebody who really to people who genuinely, deeply love this stuff. And that's, and you want to do a good job for those people too, you know, and you don't want to disappoint them. So it really keeps you honest about it in a nice way. But it is a very nice thing to do. Yes, actually, yes. Yeah.
You know, and you've had, obviously, you've been in massive movies, you've been in independent movies, including, I have to tell you, one of my all-time favorite movies is actually Barney's version.
Oh, thanks. I feel like
incredibly moving to me.
Thank you.
Is there a freedom that you're afforded in independent films like John Dies at the End that might be missing from the big studios?
It depends. You know, I mean, it's all... Yes, I mean, certainly the higher the money level goes up, the anxieties become different. You know, I mean, the lower it is, it's just a question of logistics. You can't get everything done you'd like to get done, but there often is much greater freedom. You know, the reason you don't have any money is because the movie's weird and you're going to have fun. You know, I mean, you know. And as it goes up, it can be less fun and you can feel less freedom, but that also depends on the guy making the movie. I mean, I always think that you can do tiny little movies and they can feel not fun. And you can do a big, huge thing. I always think of Planet of the Apes that I did, which was a gigantic movie. I mean, just giant. But Tim Burton did not make it feel like it was a giant movie. I mean, you felt like you were making John Dies at the End in a funny way. Mm. Even though the studio was putting a lot of shackles on everybody, him and everybody else, The face-to-face dealing with that man was so much fun. He was such a fun guy to be around, and he was having such a good time. His pleasure was in standing there with the actors and coming up with weird stuff. You know, so suddenly it felt like a small movie you were doing with this wonderful man, and so he made a difference. So, it's all just a case-by-case thing.
Yeah. Well, I had, like a lot of people, you'd first garnered my attention probably 15 years or so ago when you played Pig Vomit.
Yeah. Well, that was another example of a movie that was, that woman was, remains one of my favorite directors I ever worked with. That was so much fun doing that movie. She only cared about the actors, and she was so much fun. It was great.
Well, and this is the last question because I know you're pressed for time. But several years later, you kind of hit your stride with Sideways, and your career went off in an exciting new direction. But you've been acting a long time. Does it mean something different to you today, the pleasure you get from it, than it did at the beginning of your career?
Yes. I mean, in some ways, you kind of want to come back and recapture some of the pleasure of what it was like at the beginning of your career. That's what you start to realize again. And in some ways, yes, it just, like I say, you know, having a good day at work with good people becomes its own reward in a way, you know, to be able to just have the simple pleasure of working with people that you're enjoying. Yeah, it means a lot to be able to have that kind of thing happen over time.
Yeah.
Well, if that answers your question. I
that absolutely does. I think I only had 10 minutes with you, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. Sorry, man.
Okay. Thank you so much. I love what you do, so thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
That's it for this episode of The Best of Movie Geeks United. You can access our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews by visiting moviegeeksunited.net.